it in, folks. Lots of room. I'm Tom Iverson, an alcoholic. And it's great to see you. I'm a member of the Big Book Group of AA in Southern Pines, North Carolina, and it's great to be here. Great to be in my favorite city in the country. And in what I honestly consider to be the most yard for yard, the best, strongest service area in the North American continent. And I... And I sincerely mean that. I've never said that in any other area. And I truly do mean that. That's a great pleasure to be here. And it's a genuine pleasure to have a chance just to share one alcoholic story with a bunch of other alcoholics and friends and family. I was thinking that the greatest gift you can give anybody is your attention, isn't it? To pay attention and listen to somebody else is a tremendous gift. And I don't take that gift lightly, and I appreciate very much the opportunity of sharing just my own personal experience with you. I was thinking about, we're an unusual group of people, to say the least. We are different, to say the least. But if somebody walked down that corridor and looked in at us, we wouldn't look markedly different than any other group that assembles. We don't look any different. We don't even sound much different. But if you stopped and listened just a bit and watched us, you would observe a couple of things that I think are peculiar about us. One is that we probably laugh more easily than any group that I know in this world. I've been telling the same jokes for 35 years, and they still work. We probably cry easier than any other group that I've ever seen. You mention about a family getting reunited, and tears come. You mention about somebody's wife leaving, and tears come, and sometimes ovations come. But... We just seem to sense things a bit more and respond a bit more, and I guess it makes a great deal of sense when you think that even though we may look much like any other group, the thing that's characteristic of this group is that we are folks who have looked death bang in the eye and come back. We're folks who have genuinely experienced blindness, and now we see. We are folks who have known a special kind of bondage. And now, by the grace of God and the miracle of this program, we're free. And I guess it's for those reasons that we feel more deeply, we respond more easily, and we live most of the time with a great deal more gusto than the average crowd. And I'm just awfully glad to be here. Bob was mentioning some astounding numbers about that there are a couple of million of us now. And this chain reaction of love and service that started in Akron almost 60 years ago. When is the 10th? Next Saturday. We will be 60 years old and well... And that miraculous chain reaction has happened one link at a time. And somewhere along the line, Ann was a little bit ahead of me. Quite a bit ahead of me. I salute you, my love. 40. God, that's a ton. And somewhere along the line, that chain reaction of love and service reached me when we were about 125 or 30 strong. And thank God the link forged, and I've been able to be part of this thing that circled this globe in every direction. And I'm deeply grateful for that. I'm deeply grateful for the fact that I've been sober since I got here. That in itself is remarkable to me, that a guy like me could stay sober this long. Even more remarkable is the fact that I am just as active in Alcoholics Anonymous today as I've ever been. It certainly isn't because I'm bored. It's because what I found here is a brand new way to live, new and different than anything I've ever known, and a way of life that is genuinely rewarding and satisfying. I'm just as enthused about Alcoholics Anonymous as I've ever been, just as dynamically involved, and I still find it just as, if not more, relevant in my life than it's ever been. We are an unusual group of people. We talk to each other an awful lot. We probably listen to the spoken word more than any other group of people I know. We tell the same stories. We look like we come off a Xerox machine. And we sit and listen enthralled as we listen to the 10,000th version of the same story. It is a strange kind of phenomenon. I was thinking about, I was sitting in a meeting one time, I think the first time it really struck me, about the peculiar manner that we have in the program. And I was listening to a lady tell her story. Not unusual to listen to many ladies tell her story. And she told, it's not the most typical story, but it's not an unusual story. She described growing up in a miserable home. She described as a child getting into all kind of fantasy behavior and escaping behavior. And then as a young teenager, did like many teenagers do. She left home. And she didn't know where she's going. She just ran. And she landed up where folks of our ilk land. She landed on the street. And as a young teenage girl, she survived the only way that she knew how, by whatever it took. And as a teenage child who should have still been in high school, she was hustling on the streets. Not an unheard of story. It happens in every city in this country every day. And those stories usually end with heartbreak and tragedy. I was sitting to her listening to her tell that story. But then she described being found by some people from something called Alcoholics Anonymous. And somebody took her as a 16-year-old child, really, to a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. And somehow it struck. And somehow it stuck. And that little girl hung in and stayed sober. And she learned to live again as she learned to stay sober. And somebody told her, after she was sober for a little while, about an examination called a high school equivalency examination, that a GED that she could take, and if she passed it, would give her a high school diploma equivalent to anything in this country. And she liked that. And she went and took the exam, and she passed the thing. She became a high school graduate. Tremendously important achievement. She got turned on a little. Somebody told her about junior colleges. She enrolled in a junior college, and she's telling this story, and I'm listening. 2 years later, she had an Associate of Arts degree. She enrolled in a 4-year college, and 2 more years later, she had a bachelor degree, and then a little later, a master's degree, and then a PhD. And as I sat and listened to her, this gracious lady was a full professor in one of the leading universities in the United States of America. A marvelous story. A marvelous story to hear. What's even more marvelous and unusual to me is that there was absolutely no reaction. I was watching the crowd, like the psychiatrist at the burlesque show. I was watching the crowd. No reaction. Nobody jabbed anybody and said, "Did you hear that?" Can you imagine if she told that story in the Garden Club of South San Francisco? Jesus, they'd be talking about it for a year. In AA, the good news is that the miracles are commonplace. The miracles are commonplace. And we don't tend to overreact to those things. We see them in their perspective. Every person sitting here beginning the program of recovery or enjoying many years of the program of recovery represent the miracle of rebirth, the miracle of being given a new lease on life. And I was one like that lady. I was one who had that experience. I want to just tell you about mine. I'm a pretty fundamental kind of guy. You won't need to take any copious notes on this. I'll keep it simple enough for me to understand. I hope Deanna can. I don't know if she can translate Southern. May sound like I'm talking slow, but I'll be going fast as I can go. That's I'm a fundamentalist kind of guy. I'm not a tunnel vision guy, but I'm a pretty basic sort of fella. I belong to a big book group, and that connotes the kind of program that I'm geared to. And when I think about this program, what it's about, I really like to think of it in context of the program. And when I look at our book, you know, our book is a fantastic thing. It's 164 pages of text. My God, you could read it in a night. I've been studying it for 38 years. And I'm still a student. I'm not a teacher yet, John. I'm not a teacher at all. I'm a student of the book. And when I look at the book, this book describes me. And it describes our illness. When I think of my alcoholism, I think of the way our book deals with our alcoholism. And what our book describes is an illness that's threefold in nature. The way the book treats it, the way I read it. Threefold in nature. First, it's a spiritual illness. It's fundamentally a spiritual illness remedied by a spiritual program. So I think it's the crux of the issue. And when I think about the spiritual malady, I think of where my alcoholism started. And if you ask me where my alcoholism started, it would be a simple thing for me. It started well before my first drink. And it started in the battle of the spirit. Now, won't go into a lot of detail on any of this, but just highlight enough to see that this is where my alcoholism comes from, and it's very basic to what the program recovery is about to me. Now, I was born down in the South. I hate to admit it, but I was born in South Carolina, not North Carolina. Lousy start, Jesus. Really bad place. I was born on an old dirt farm it looked like what Erskine Caldwell wrote about it. It was just a terrible place. I was born during the Depression. I've heard some folks say they were poor but didn't know it. I had a doggone good idea that we were poor. If we weren't, I'd hate to see somebody that was, man. We didn't have nothing. But we were fervent in our beliefs. And my family were rabid fundamentalist folk. And I don't mean any disrespect. I mean, I know y'all may have a strange preacher or two out here. In fact, we've sent you some from over our way. I don't mean disrespect to that, but because most of the people in that persuasion did better than I did. I just happened to be one with whom it didn't take. And as a young child, it became clear to me that there was a great deal of what those folks talked about and got excited about that I simply didn't believe. And I remember the enormous sense of fear and guilt when I acknowledged, recognized that I dared to disbelieve something as omnipotent, as fearsome as God. And what set up in me, and I think was the foundation of my alcoholism, was the way I resolved it. Because the way I resolved it was by burying those thoughts and ideas and feelings deep inside. And I never shared with one human being until I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous what my real feelings and belief were about matters of the spirit. And what I set up was a deep-seated sense of conflict where I felt one way on the inside and acted quite another way on the outside. And that tension and aggravation and frustration was the seedbed from which alcoholism eventually grew. It went on into frustration and aggravation and anger and resentment and finally to just cold indifference. The opposite of love is not hate. It's indifference. And where the Spirit should have been in my life, what I had instead was what I hear often described in AA. That kind of hole in the soul. That emptiness. That shell of a feeling. And when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know they're our Father. nor have any concern about it. It just was a nothing kind of issue. Seedbed. That kind of stressful feeling that set about that little piece of difference. The second way our book describes the illness is as it's a mental illness, an emotional illness, a mental illness, characterized by obsessive thoughts about alcohol, a preoccupation with alcohol, a mental, emotional kind of illness. Let me just mention one other kind of causation thing that links in my mind. Now, I'm not a causation freak. I'm not somebody who likes to cast the net and draw everybody under my tent of blame. I'm not that. But at the same time, I'm not dumb enough to think that I was born in a vacuum. Yeah, obviously, I'm a creature of my environment and of my lineage and my heritage. So while we're in this non-victim bashing mode, I don't want to overreact to that and fail to recognize what's obvious. That was obviously part of me. I'll just mention one thing and kind of rush on in my rapid way. My family broke up when I was 4 years old. I barely remember it, but I do remember it. And I remember the day my dad left. And somehow, though he didn't tell me, somehow I knew he wasn't coming back. And I remember that kind of sadness about that. And it just happened. And then I saw the fellow two more times in my formative years, and then never again until I was sober a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, if you'd had asked me anything about my father during my active alcoholism, I'd have said, there ain't none. It ain't no big deal. If you had asked me about my first 10 years of recovery, I would have said, there is none. It's no big deal. Little did I understand the impact that the absence of a father has in the life of a child, particularly with a boy. Certainly with a girl, too. Now, you know, obviously, I don't mean to get parenthood, but each parent has their value. There's nothing like a mother. The biggest day for restaurants in the known world is Mother's Day. Nobody's ever taken a father out for dinner, I don't think. Mother is where it's at. But father ain't chopped liver. I mean, he's still got some too, you know. Well, I never understood that. I never studied much about it, and I never really understood that until I had a son of my own. And I started to see in my son what a father contributes to a son. Never had occurred to me before. And I started watching my son watch me. When I started watching him learn what a man is like by interacting with me. I watched him learn to shave by watching me shave. I watched him laugh at my goofy habits and then pick them up as his own. And it started to dawn on me that you don't really miss something you never had. And I had never really thought about that. You know, my mother had remarried to a bunch of nice guys after we... Not all at once, you know, but they were in succession and quite a few... But none of them ever fill that role. And then I started to realize something about the tremendous importance of building trust, of building a sense of intimacy and closeness and identification. See, I never went fishing with a man in my life till I was a grown man. Never went hunting with a man in my life till I was a grown man. Never had a serious problem-solving discussion with a man in my life till I was a grown man. And I didn't understand that until long into recovery. Well, enough said. What happened as a result of that was what I hear every alcoholic I've ever heard talk when they describe that sort of awkward existence of being unable to relate to those about them. Either feeling superior, inferior, separated, isolated. And what we read about over and over in that book, that sense of self-centered isolation. Self-centered isolation. Now, I made a lot of noise, I interacted with a lot of people, but I never had any sense of closeness with any human till I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so what I had was that kind of awkward kind of adolescence thing of trying to plug into life and being unable to do so. Well, along in those teenage years is where booze came into my life. And when I found booze, man, it was an absolute turn-on to me because what I found in booze was a solution to everything that I ever felt. It gave me that sense of confidence and poise and well-being. It gave me the nerve to do anything I dared to even dream of doing. And it gave me everything I needed. And there's no mystery what happened. I found a magical solution. I would have been stupid not to drink. And I wasn't stupid, man. I mean, I took to it with a purple passion. Loved everything about it. And so what I found was not a problem. I wasn't an alcoholic. I wasn't an instant alcoholic. I was a troubled young fella who found a magical solution in a very economical package called booze. And brother, did I ever take to it. And what happened to me, I think, that was significant in this whole mental setup, this whole emotional mental package, this illness that we call the mental illness, is that branded on my brain, branded deeply in my brain, is solution, solution, solution. And that's what booze represented to me. It was a solution. And it never quit being. It always worked as a solution. But unfortunately, over the years, it took on some baggage. And the problem, the solution became the problem. A peculiar kind of thing. What at one time freed me from that prison of self-centered isolation and made me free as a bird became the keys to a prison that locked me up more tightly than I've ever been, in a prison that it built one glass brick at a time. A prison so strong that I couldn't get out, nobody else could get in. A prison in which I was to know loneliness as very few people know, other than other alcoholics. You know, now, I don't think alcoholics corner the market on loneliness. My God, every human knows loneliness. Now, if you really want to see loneliness, Don and I were talking today about, and many of us have to deal with it, the thing of having to put loved ones in a nursing home. If you really want to see loneliness, dare to walk into a nursing home and spend 10 minutes. And I'll guarantee you, you'll see a kind of loneliness that you could never imagine. Ours isn't like that. Ours isn't the loneliness of isolation of that sort. The loneliness of those who are imprisoned in those conditions can usually be lifted by one loving human. That's all it takes. Not so with us, is it? That mental illness, that emotional separation, really rears its head in strange ways. I've known the loneliness of alcoholism in a wild party. I've known it on Christmas Eve in the circle of my family. I've known it in the arms of a loving woman. It has little to do. One of my pigeons, he's been out here a couple of times, I love to hear him talk about this situation with the family, where he would come home drunk and go to bed with a wife that he no longer knew, and both of them lie in the bed, rigid as boards, pretending to be asleep because they simply didn't know what to say to each other. I would submit to you, fellow alcoholics, that that's the hell of alcoholism. The hell of alcoholism is not measured by lost jobs, broken noses, jails, wrecked cars. It's not measured by that. It's measured by the agony of being unable to link with other humans, even those who are nearest and dearest to us. So that mental illness, let me just mention two other aspects of it and then move. It really has to do, that's the setup. That's the thing that makes the solution so powerful and that fact so dangerous. That fact so dangerous. See, what's more dangerous to me than anything else about alcoholism is what I know about it that's true. And that's the fact that's ever present that is the solution. That poses more danger to me than anything else, because I will never forget. That's not just a belief. That's a fact. It's a solution. And I never lose sight of it. And characterize that mental thing, characterized by this preoccupation and periodically an obsession to drink. An obsession to drink. And I'm not talking about a desire to drink. I'm talking about finding myself back drinking as a result of an obsession. I explain a little bit more about that a little bit later on. The other thing that's peculiar about it to me, that mental thing, is a thing called delusion. Delusion. An inability to see my behavior. I repeated the same pitiful performances hundreds of times and never saw them till I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Last way our book talks about the illness is the physical thing. The physical thing. And not just the physical damage, it describes something I don't understand, but it describes that our class develops a phenomenon of craving, that it seems to be physiological. I don't understand that. I just simply know that it happened to me. Yeah, I really like the way our book describes it. There's one line, now you can read all kinds of flaming description of it. There's one line that I like very much. In the third chapter, More About Alcoholism, third paragraph, first line says, "We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking." And I like that definition. I like it because it's a no-nonsense matter of fact kind of statement. It has nothing to do with whether I am male or female. It has nothing to do with whether I'm gay or straight, whether I'm white or black or brown or whatever. Has nothing to do with that. Has nothing to do with whether I'm rich or poor, educated or stupid. It has nothing to do with that. It has nothing to do with how much trouble I got into, by the way. It has nothing to do with how many cars I wrecked, how many jails I was in. Those are certainly aggravating occupational hazards for some of us. But they're not the crux of the issue. I like that statement. We alcoholics and men and women have lost the ability to control our drinking, because that says what the nut of the issue is. The fact of the business is that for some reason, and the thing that I think closes the door on alcoholism and separates me from every other drinker in this world, is that one simple statement. I do not have the ability to control my drinking. I lost it. And I don't understand it. I don't need to understand it. I just need to know at the depth of my being that it happened. And that's the foundation that I speak to you from tonight, is that realization and that truth. The most important thing that I know about me is the fact that I cannot drink booze. Well, what, you know, when I look at the thing that happened, you know, in order for me to understand my alcoholism, all I have to do is look at the two extremes of it. I look at that bright young fellow who bounced out of Belmont, by the way. There's one near here. I went to school in the little town of Belmont. I bounced out of high school in Belmont when I was 16 years old. Bright-eyed and bushy-tailed to a point. Ready to set out and make my mark in this world. And then compare him to the fellow who 8 short years later was living on the streets in the city of Flint, Michigan. Grungy place. God knows that's a grungy place. It was voted a few years ago the worst place in the United States in which to live. I helped to put it on that list. I guess. Terrible place. And I wound up, I went up there with just wandering, you know, as sometimes we do. And that's where I really, really bit the dust. That's where I just lost it. I was unemployed, darn near unemployable. I'd come up for air every once in a while and get some hole, and then a few days later I'm gone again. And you know, my most frequent address the last year that I lived in that city was the Rialto Theater. It wasn't because of like movies. It just happened to be the cheapest room in town. For 35 cents you could get in out of the cold, and I don't even know if they ran movies or not. It didn't matter. I never want to forget. I pray to my God that I never forget for one second what the nature of my alcoholism was about. I never want to drift into thinking that it was just some cute little mischievous behavior that got out of hand. I never want to get to thinking that I was just a guy who drank a little too much and it was a situational thing. I never want to get to thinking or lose the clear and vivid memory of what it was like for one second, because mine was not some social nuisance behavior. Mine was a killer disease. And I have absolutely no doubt I'd have drunk myself to death if I'd just been left. I never want to forget what it felt like to wander the streets of that city and be absolutely alone and absolutely meaningless in that entire place. I look at people today. I never walk past a street person that I don't feel a quick flash of identification. Because I know that lost and empty feeling that wherever you go, it's just that constant empty feeling of desperation and hopelessness and despair and just wanting to give up. Never want to forget that. Never want to forget what it was like to take handouts from strangers. Well-intended people, I know. I appreciated the gifts. But I also remember the tremendous demeaning feeling that was associated with it. I never want to forget what it was like to go to jail over and over and over and jitter joints and psych wards. I never want to forget it. I never want to forget what it felt like to line up and sell my blood for $5 a throw. That's what my kind did. That's what I did. Well, on and on. I wish I could tell you that one day I just had enough of it and threw in the towel and called AA and everything's been okay. But unfortunately, it just didn't happen that way with me. Because I was one of those who stayed there too long and wound up doing the kind of thing that I know every alcoholic in this room, in this world, for that matter, has feared doing. I know every time, I've done it 1,000 times, and every time I listen to alcoholics tell their stories, I hear the same kind of thing, particularly with those who've had blackouts, that panicky feeling when you first wake up in the morning, afraid to open your eyes and think, what the devil have I done now? Where am I supposed to be? And have a story ready just in case. And then wake up, breathe a sigh of relief, and you find yourself at home. Then go out to see if the car's there, to see if it's in one piece, to see if there's blood on it. And then dodge the bullet again and go do it again. Done it 100 times. One morning I woke up in Flint, in jail. No novelty to that. My God, I'd been there more times and knew everybody worked there. Most everybody locked up there, and it was a normal thing for me. And I assumed when I was in there that it was the same as always, either drunk or hustling or fighting or what have you. And was greeted with the fact that the night before I'd been driving somebody's car down to Main Street City and had run down and killed 2 people. And my reaction was, if you could imagine, I don't know if anybody could ever imagine, I don't think I could imagine, the shock of that kind of news. I simply could not believe it. Even though I was a street character, I was not a subhuman. I was not an insensitive person. I simply could not deal with that. And then I just pushed it away and then gradually accepted the fact I'd done more damage than any drunk ever ought to be allowed to do. Only time I'd ever been in jail, didn't try to get out. I didn't even tell them where I was from. And then they eventually found out. Somebody called my folks down in North Carolina and they came up and negotiated my release on bond. I was charged with manslaughter. I was released after 76 days, knew that I wouldn't drink. I didn't think I could physically pick up a drink. The guilt was too great. Little did I know that it was the least likely time that I would ever stop drinking. I stayed sober a day and a half, and then, of course, I drank. My God. And from July to November of 1956, I drank like nobody I've ever seen. Now, that's not a macho statement. I mean, I was what they call a pathological drinker. I was obviously trying to drink myself to death, and obviously that didn't happen. Then November the 19th of 56, I had what I hope and pray was my last drink. Didn't know it was going to be my last one, but I knew it was going to be the last one for a long time. Finished a little piece of a bottle of gin, went down to court. It was not a trial in any sense like we see today, but I really thought that it was an eloquent kind of thing that happened. They asked for my plea, and I entered a plea called stand mute. What can you say when you don't know? I couldn't even tell them what I'd done. They had to tell me what I'd done. I was obviously found guilty and sentenced to a max of 15 years in the Michigan State Penitentiary. And yeah, even though I'd been in jails all over the place, I'd never been in anything that was serious big time. And I knew that was. I mean, I'd hustled around the streets with a lot of guys that had been in and out of there. And I knew I was not going to Disneyland. I knew that that was bad news. Jackson Prison, where I went, is a maximum joint. I would rate it the second or third worst penitentiary in this country. You've got one or two here that would compete very well. Well, when I walked into that place, I never believed I would ever come out of there alive, and I truly didn't care. Truly didn't care. I just wanted to be gone. I just wanted to be put away, and I had no thoughts of trying to desperately look for an out like I'd always done. I was just absolutely resigned to my fate. And one day, a guy came over and interviewed me. Called me out of cell and interviewed me and talked to me about my alcoholism. A lot of people had done that. But he did something nobody else had ever done. He said, we have an AA group here and I think you better go. It was exactly what he put. Didn't have to. It wasn't an invitation. It was not an order. Just a flat statement. We have a group think you better go. And in Groundhog Day of 57 was the day I walked into this brand new way of life. Had no earthly idea what to expect, just like you, I'm sure. And I walked in, no idea what would happen. And I've never looked back. And yeah, it takes something awfully powerful to change the course of events for a 24-year-old piece of human wreckage like that. This is not melodrama. This is a darn fact. I look back on the first 24 years of my life, and it would have genuinely been better had it never happened by any description, by any measure. Been better had it never happened. There was not one thing that I could look back on to this day and say, well, at least I did that. I don't know of anything I successfully completed whatsoever. I don't know of anybody who ever got associated with me didn't get dirty in the process or disappointed. And as I was not a prime candidate for this program. And what is it that happens that turns it around? What is it that causes, once, you know, some of us come in here and are as fortunate as I've been that I grabbed that brass ring the first day. And I've held on to that sucker ever since. And that's the case with some people, and God knows it's great when it happens. There are others who lose it, and then they grab it again, and they grab it again, and finally grab it, and some never can. I don't know what the difference is. I don't know. I can only report to you what happened to me. And I went to that meeting as lost. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I was 24 years old, youngest guy in there. I didn't think anybody could be an alcoholic at 24. I said I was. I hated to be the only one in there that wasn't. And so they all said they were. And I said, yeah, me too. But it didn't mean a thing. Didn't mean a single thing. I just kept going to those meetings. First 8 months that I was in there, I truly believe were the most miserable period I ever endured in my life. Alcoholics Anonymous can be a tremendously lonely place. When you're here and you see all this loving and sharing and warmth and giving, it's great to see if you're in on it. If you ain't in on it, brother, I guarantee you this can be a lonely, miserable place. And I was a miserable cat. I didn't understand there were some things going on. And I'll just share with you a couple of things that happened to me that were significant, even though I didn't know it. One, the recovery group in Jackson Prison was an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous, thank God. And what I mean by that, it was a group that was well-ordered and well-structured. It was built on principles. It was a group that carried out the fifth tradition to help other alcoholics. It was a group that did a fantastic job of teaching newcomers about the design for living that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll always be grateful for that. For the no-nonsense way in which it was lovingly given to me by other guys in that joint, just like me. And the only difference was they were a little in front of me. I'll always be grateful for that. Talk a little more about that in the morning at the H&I thing. The other thing that I really think it balances out had to do with the people who carried that message to me. The guys, and it was no gals then, it was all guys who walked into that institution week after week after week. Every shape and size of people who walked in and stuck out the right hand of fellowship and offered it to me with absolutely no question, no demands. People who accepted me not as I was, but at the level of what I could become. I was treated like a gentleman long before I became one, I promise you that, by loving members of Alcoholics Anonymous who cared and shared what they had. I'll always be grateful for that because that was the lifeline. I was just up a couple of months ago to speak at the 51st anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous in Ann Arbor, in Michigan. And I had one of the truly mountaintop experiences I've ever had. A little guy by the name of Jimmy Fondren, who is 92 years old and more active than 80% of the members in this program to this day, I had the privilege of giving back one of the few tangible expressions of my deep gratitude to one of the guys that had carried the message to me when I gave him a 51-year chip.
Sure. Special. They didn't want appreciation, but I'll guarantee you I relished the opportunity to just say thanks. I guess there are other ways that we say thanks, aren't there? The thanks is in what we do, not in what we say. I'd always be grateful for that. But it takes more than just a good hard-nosed kind of introduction. It takes more than a heartwarming kind of relationship. Now, what is it that gives somebody a solid enough foundation that they can not only survive but learn to live? What is it that produces the freedom and the happiness and the joy? Well, I think about it, the way I described the alcoholism in terms of how our book describes it. And, when I think about it, now I think about the powerful value of action, of being physically involved. About being just in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and feeling that sense of belonging. Now, the sense of belonging is an elusive thing. You can sit in a meeting and feel totally alone. Where does the sense of belonging generate? To me, it generates very simply. It's by a thing called action. If there's any magic in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's spelled A-C-T-I-O-N. When I'm working with newcomers, I don't like to brainwash them with steps right off the bat. I want to brainwash that sucker with action. I want him to get off his duff and do something. I don't care whether he means it, whether he feels like it. I just want him to get into action. And in the course of getting into action, you get into the spirit of belonging. That's what happened to me because I got pushed into some action in this program and some marvelous things started to happen. How valuable that is. Everything I've ever done in Alcoholics Anonymous, including this tonight, I have always done with a little edge of anxiety and a little edge of uncertainty. If I had waited until I felt like doing the things that I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous, as of now, I would have done a net zero. That's where the growth comes. And so I'll always be grateful. I'm a great believer in feeling the sense of belonging to Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember, Bob, when I got to be secretary of the group after a couple of years. If you can imagine this, a guy in a max joint, and I was curious about something, and some guys in the group were curious. We wanted to know where the preamble came from. And nobody knew in the group. So I wrote a letter to the General Service Office. The guy in a max joint. I didn't really expect an answer. I got back a 2-page letter with detailed description of where they thought it came from. Nobody really knew. But what a great feeling to feel that sense of linkage, that sense of belonging. Yeah, I'm a great believer in home groups. I'm not somebody who's much for chatty little meetings. I am a home group person. I'm somebody who believes very strongly in that sense of belonging that comes from a well-developed group that represents all of our legacies and not just one. Something that represents something that's lasting and not just a one-hour little visit. So I'm a great believer in those kinds of things. The other thing that when I look at that, in terms of how this recovery occurs, the physical thing obviously comes first. Yeah, I had recovered physically hundreds of times. It doesn't take long. It doesn't take a genius to recover physically. All it takes is don't drink. If I don't drink, I will recover remarkably fast, usually within a week. Don't usually need medication. Don't usually need hospitalization. It just happens if I don't drink. The only problem was every time I'd ever recovered, what happened? I went right back. So what was different this time? What is it that has made this recovery last this many years? Well, it ain't nothing profound about that to me. It has to do with a simple thing that we capsulize in one word and we call it bottom. Bottom to me means a great deal more than physical suffering, emotional suffering, financial suffering. Bottom to me has to do with a thing called surrender. Surrender. It's recognizing at a cellular level that my problem is that I cannot drink alcohol. See, I was an alcoholic not because I killed two people, not because I was in a penitentiary, not because I'd been divorced from everybody I'd ever married, not any of that stuff. Those things happened because I was alcoholic. And what I have to recognize is that at the depth of my being, my issue is that I cannot drink. You know, I run into folks a lot, and I used to say it myself, run into folks who say that one of the good things that's come in sobriety is choice. The opportunity to make choices. I don't really say that anymore because I don't really think it's relevant to my beliefs anymore. Because a choice is an evaluation of options. It's an evaluation of options. It's looking at alternatives and choosing the better. That isn't what I do. That's not what I do. What I recognize is that alcohol is not an option for me. It's not something that I elect not to do. It's something that I recognize that I cannot do. Big difference. I fought one hellacious war with alcohol. And I lost. I lost. So there is no fight. I surrender and there is no fight. It's not a war. It's important for me to understand that at a very fundamental level because I want to stay sober for a long time. I want to stay sober for the rest of my life. And it's important for me to understand so that I can look the long view of this thing. We were talking about this business of getting caught up. If I can't be happy, I might as well be drunk. Be careful of that. I mean, you know, what we get restored to is life. Life. This ain't Disneyland. I mean, this is life. And sometimes it is good. Sometimes it is marvelous. Sometimes it just pure sucks. I've been so deep in the well that I swear to God I didn't think I could put one foot in front of the other. But I've hung on. And how tremendously important it is to hang on and get through those things and take the long view. And the physical reality is part of that. The middle thing, you know, what is it that keeps this from being just some grim, white-knuckled battle? What is it that keeps it from being a constant kind of negative thing of saying, I won't drink? What is it that keeps the tiger in the cage? Where does the freedom come from? It comes from a thing that we call the 12 steps. I just mentioned three categories that I like to think about in the steps that have to do with that thing. You know, our program is a set of principles, spiritual in their nature, that if practiced as a way of life, will expel the obsession to drink and render the sufferer usefully whole. Something like that. Now that's kind of a nice cliche way of saying it. What that really means to me. When I look at the steps, I look at the first three. And they basically have to do with two things. One, they have to do with total surrender. Just what I just got through doing. I can't drink. And importantly, they have to do with establishing a relationship with a power greater than me. Unnamed. Thank God in this program we start where we are, no matter where that is, not where we ought to be. A relationship with a power greater than me. A lot of people stay sober just at that point, never take another drink. I've known many people who never went that far or even that far. It's not enough for me because I want to be free. I want to be free of that obsession. I want to be free of that drive and I want to have a new way to live. And the rest of the steps are what does it. The next four basically have to do with my relationship with myself. The inventory steps in four and five help me understand what my alcoholism is. They help me understand what it looks like. They help me understand what its face is and what the true nature of the illness is about. And then six and seven simply have to do with decision. Simply have to do a decision of being ready to have God remove these things and asking Him to do so. Sounds like a nice little pablum thing to say. What it really represents to me is the point of decision. Do I want to get well or don't I? Am I willing to change or aren't I? Am I willing to take a stand for something for the first time in my life? Am I willing to deal with values and standards? Am I willing to say no when yes is so easy? They say in some of our literature that it's the transition that separates the men from the boys, the women from the girls. And I believe it. The relationship with me. I know what my illness is. Do I want to get rid of it? Or do I want to stay in that sucker? And it's not always an easy question. Relationship with me. Who am I and what am I about? And then the rest has to do with that business of freedom, of finding the freedom. Let me just mention about one quick thing on the inventory thing, and I want to talk about the journey. Yeah, the freedom, it's interesting to me how deep-seated this thing is and how deep the bondage rests in my life. Now, I mentioned that thing about my debt and the fact that I had never been troubled with that to my knowledge until years into recovery. And when I was sober some 10 or 12 years, I guess, something like that, I started to become aware of some real uneasiness in that area. Really didn't believe what I was feeling because I started to feel that I needed to go make amends to that guy, and I didn't even know him. And all he'd ever done was desert the family. And I started to get trouble with the fact that I had amends to make, and I got into the most skitsy conversation you've ever heard. You need to go. No, I ain't going. Man, you nuts. I ain't going. And then finally recognized that I needed to go because this wasn't about him. This was about me. And I went to South Carolina where he lived. Served him right. There's a good place for him. So I went to see him, found out where he lived, and went, walked up unannounced. And there he was in the backyard talking to a neighbor. And I greeted him. He didn't even know who I was. And I told him. And he was embarrassed, of course. And the neighbor left, and we started to visit. And I told him why I was there. I have never tried to make amends to anybody of a personal nature like that, who didn't want to pat me on the head and say, now, that's okay. You just stay sober. It's always awkward and embarrassing for them. And I told him that I really needed to talk to him and why. And I sat down and made amends to that man. Now, there's no real happy end to this. We didn't become great buddies and go play golf or anything or go fishing. You know, this guy just couldn't be a father. He just couldn't be a father. He wasn't made that way. But it wasn't about his fatherhood. It was about my sonhood. And I walked out of there a free man. A free man. And I was able to function as a son to him and to his family. You know, that's how deep the thing goes. And because what I found was everywhere I owed amends, it was because of a warped and twisted relationship that had come about. Every time I screwed somebody, it cost me a piece of my soul. And that's why I need to be free. And to do that, I've got to root out those things that own me. You always wonder, about, where does it go? What is it that changes it just from a sort of a me-focused thing into a real way of life that includes great joy? It's always impressive to me that where that shows up is in the end of the program where we start to actively work with other people. I always wondered, I guess a lot of people do, like, what is this for me? I'll tell you what I believe. Every single person who comes into this program and practices it as a way of life, at some point will have an avenue of service open for them. Now, I believe that. Let me tell you what else I believe. I believe without any question that the quality of my recovery will depend directly on whether I accept it or reject it. When the avenue of service opens, I will either grow by acceptance or I will diminish my recovery by rejection. There ain't no free lunch. And there's a peculiar kind of transition that has to occur, I think, where we move from the me thinking to the we thinking. It's a peculiar kind of selfishness. See, I don't think my recovery happened because I deserved it, and I doubt that anybody would make a case for me. How does a guy like me justify even being here? I believe that every recovery has a purpose. I believe that every person in this room has a story that somebody needs to hear. They don't need to hear mine. They need to hear yours. And I think it's my obligation to share that with those behind me. Now, I think where that comes from for me is in the 11th step where it says to pray and meditate and then looking for what? Praying only for knowledge of God's will for me and the power to carry it out. Strange kind of thing that opens up and you never know what it's going to be. And then the last one has to do with just actively doing it. And what that set up for me has been a way of life beyond anything that I could possibly imagine. I'm going to wrap up on the thing that I know a lot of people chew me out if I don't tell this aspect of my life. And sometimes I do have mixed feelings about doing so, but I feel great ambivalence about doing so because I'm somebody who has had some marvelous things happen in my life, some unbelievable things, much like that lady that was I told you about in the beginning. I sometimes stand in awe of what this program's done in my life and in disbelief, really. I just tell you right quick what happened and the reason I do is because I know, even though I back away sometimes, I remember how tremendously important it was for me when I heard people talk about their lives coming together and about restoration and about some things going right in their lives and how much hope it gave me. So for anybody that might be wavering in the hope department, let me just share with you what happened to this guy. I left that institution eventually. I stayed there 3.5 years and then they told me they would parole me if I would agree to go to North Carolina. And it took me about 1/1000th of a second of contemplation. And I said, yeah, I'll grudgingly go. And then they released me to North Carolina. I didn't really want to go. I'd seen the bright lights in the big cities and I didn't want to go. But God, I wanted out. And when I left that place, it was with a deep conviction that I have to this day that I will never go into that way of life again. I meant that. Now, I didn't mean some braggadocio statement that they can't put me back. That's not what I mean. I meant I was willing to pay the price and I didn't care what it was. And I hit the ground running, made a meeting the first night, got a job in a mill, sweeping the floor on the night shift, 10 at night to 6 in the morning, didn't miss a meeting for years and was never late for work. I was a very grateful man to be free physically. I've been free for a long time, but physically it meant a great deal to be free as well. I got immediately active in the program. My group sponsored a little small institution, a prison over near my home. Second week I was out, I didn't know I could go, and they said, come go with us. And I said, yeah, sure. So I went over. About 2 months after I was out, I became outside sponsor of that group. Can you imagine what an affirmation for a guy that's just coming out of a max joint? And they give me the trusted servant position of carrying the message back to guys like I just left. And meant a lot to me. About the same time, my parole supervisor came to me one day and he said, Tom, you're real active in this AA thing, aren't you? And I said, yes, sir. And it worried me because I thought he was going to tell me to slow down. And I knew it wouldn't. And he said, wouldn't it help you if you could drive? And I said, yes, sir, but I can't. Like he didn't know. When I'd left Michigan, they'd put in letters that big on my paper, this man's never operated a motor vehicle, this man never drink alcoholic beverages, and I accepted that as a fact of life, and it never occurred to me. And he said, well, let me take a look at that. A couple weeks later, I got a call, and he asked me to meet him at the Sears store uptown, and you know, this really sounds country. That's where the driver's license agency was in my town, I went up, and this story is true in absolute detail. I walked up to the front of that place. I could see all the way to the back of the store where he was standing. My parole guy was standing with another man I didn't know and turned out to be the license agent. I walked in, walked up to the guy. My parole supervisor introduced me to the man, and the man handed me a driver's license. Didn't even ask me if I could drive. Didn't even pay for it. You know that had to be illegal. Ain't no way you do it. I didn't take a test, nothing. I've had some people tell me, they say, well, you must have really been politically connected. I sure was. I knew one politician, that was the sheriff in that county, used to
used to lock me up all the time.
I tell you what I truly believe it is. When God's got work for you to do, the walls come down. And I don't care what the walls are. I know that not only on my own example, but on the example of God knows how many people that have had unbelievable experiences that I just absolutely marvel at. About 5 months after I was out, they had election for DCM in my area, and I wasn't running. Most people aren't. But but I was elected by acclamation as DCM. Now, that doesn't mean much to the average cat. I guarantee it meant something to me, because I had genuinely wondered when I left that institution if I would ever have one friend or if one person would ever trust me again. Here were the AA members in 12 cities, the closest people in this world to me, asking me to be their trusted servant. And I agreed, my God. 2 years after I was out, sitting in my house one day, got a phone call from the state capitol, and it was a fellow that I'd met one time. He visited the AA group that I sponsored, and he said, Mr. Ivester, said we're thinking of expanding the rehabilitation thing in our prisons. Said we wondered if you would consider accepting a position. And I swear, the first thing I said to him was, are you sure you know who you're talking to? And he told me he did. I'd never been offered a job in my life. And this guy told me what he had in mind, and I said, God, I'd rather do that than anything in the world, but you know what I said inside. Never been an ex-con in history hired anything like that. They ain't going to start with you, Jack. But by golly, they did. And I was employed in the North Carolina Department of Correction, and I've been there ever since. I've worked about eight years or so in rehab. I loved it. I was mud wrestling with the guys and all this stuff, and just loved it. And then one day I started getting pushed toward management a bit. One day I was called in to the office of the head of the prison system, and he said, Tom, I've got an assignment I'd like you to take. And I said, yes, sir, what is it? And I thought he wanted me to talk to a Rotary Club. That is what I figured it was. And he said, I would like for you to take over an institution as warden. I thought, my God, yeah, it was just such a shock. I mean, even though I was working there, it was a shock, because I guarantee you, of all the pipe dreams and fantasies you ever have in a maximum custody joint, you don't ever just sit there and say, one of these days I'm going to get out of here and run one of these suckers. Well, and my real reaction was I wasn't sure I wanted to do it. I didn't want to be the man. I reckon I might be able to do some stuff with some influence that I might not otherwise be able to do. And I accepted it. And for the next 20 years, that's what I did is run institutions. I developed a number of institutions. I had a great career, and it's a lousy job, but it meant a lot to me. And I'm still in the system. I'm on the staff of the secretary now. I'm doing state level stuff, and it's a great, great career. I guess what they do with old folks, they put them on the shelf in the head shed and lose them, you know. But no, I'm busier than I've ever been in my life, just like I am in the program and having a marvelous time. But that's not what really counts. What really counts, and I guess the where that real spiritual healing comes, you know, where the joy comes from. You know, what is it? It means something. I'm a guy from a little town in North Carolina. It's about not as big as that airport over there. It's just a little old place. 2,000 or 3,000 stout-hearted souls. But it's home. It's home. First place that I've ever truly been a functioning citizen. That doesn't mean much to folks that have always been citizens. But if you'd ever been to a place where you weren't one, you might know what it means. I'm a citizen and a good one. I pay taxes and I vote and I've served on school councils. Yeah, I've just, it's home. It's my town. Got a home there that the bank and I own. And right now, we own more than the bank does. It's strange. I'm married. My wife is here with me this weekend. Next month, we'll be celebrating 27 years of continuous marriage. That's unbelievable. That's something. And we got a couple of kids. My daughter's here. She graduated last year from University of North Carolina, and I have a
a son who will graduate from medical school at Carolina next year. And that's those are things you don't dream about when you're sitting in a Max joint. They mean a great deal, though, to me personally. I'm just who I said I was. I'm an average guy in an average town. I belong to the Big Book group, and you can bet I belong to that group. I'm the newly elected GSR of that group. I'm probably the oldest one in America, Bob. But I'm somebody who believes in service, and I believe in doing what I believe in. And I'm somebody who's had a marvelous way to live. You know, the day I walked in here, what I started out on was the greatest adventure that I could possibly imagine. And I think the key to that adventure is learning how to open up, learning how to say yes, and learning how not to say no. Giving myself to this simple program, and God knows it's given me back more than I ever dreamed. The good news is, that's available to anybody. I wish you well. Thanks.